From Troy Public Radio, this is In Focus Weekend, and I'm Carolyn Hutchison. Thanks for joining us this weekend as we head south to the small town of Two Egg, Florida, to find out how it ended up with such a colorful name. But first, consider the phrase, dope with lime. If you're scratching your head about what this might mean, stay with us as we talk with Matthew Touch, director of the Lillian E. Smith Center in Clayton, Georgia, and host of a podcast with that interesting title. Before we begin, here's a hint. Dope with lime is slang for a very popular beverage, and later Lillian Smith used it as the name of her newspaper column. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us from the North Georgia Mountains.
Thank you for having me.
As director of the Lillian E. Smith Center at Piedmont University in Northeast Georgia, you are host producer of a special podcast about a special woman. How did all of this come about?
So the Lillian Smith Center came about. Piedmont University started the center in around 2014, 2015. Before Piedmont University got involved, it was actually part of Lillian Smith's family. Her niece, Nancy Smith Fichter, and Nancy Smith Fichter's husband, Robert Fichter, were from Tallahassee, Florida. Nancy taught modern dance at Florida State University and brought the modern dance program to Florida State. And they had the property as an artist retreat. And it's the property where Lillian Smith used to live and worked, and where she actually ran Laurel Falls Camp for Girls from 1925 through 1948. And then Piedmont University took over the property and maintained it as an artist and scholar retreat, a science research area, and as a social justice educational center, too, for educators, P-12 educators, university educators.
How did the podcast get started?
The podcast started and came out of Dope with Lime, which was the editorial that Lillian wrote in the journal that her and her partner, Paula Snelling, published. And that was the name of the editorial. So the title came from that. And the podcast includes excerpts from Lillian Smith's work, her interviews with scholars and artists and former residents, all talking about Lillian Smith and her influence.
So Lillian Smith was considered sort of a social activist in the 1940s, right ahead of the civil rights movement itself. Did she have a connection with Martin Luther King Jr.?
She did. And one of the things I always say is, upon her death in 1966, Martin Luther King Jr. wrote to her family, and this is what he said to her family. Her writings, her exemplary life, and her commitment to people and humanity inspired millions. She was one of the brightest stars in the human firmament. Probably no Southerner seared the conscience of white Southerners on the question of racial injustice than Lillian Smith. And the other two big things about her connection with King is she wrote to him in 56 with the Montgomery bus boycott. And they started a connection. And one of the things that's really fascinating is King said in his reply to Lillian that, "I've read your work for years, and I'm glad to finally meet you in person." And then she and King gave speeches at the first annual Institute on Nonviolence and Social Change in Montgomery in 56, which was the one-year anniversary of the bus boycotts. And those speeches were reprinted and published in Phylon and the New York Times as a pamphlet. She was also very much connected with King with the Atlanta sit-ins. One of the things that I found out was right before the Atlanta sit-ins, she gave a keynote speech at a SNCC conference 3 days before the sit-ins. So she was connected with all of this, with the movement and with King.
You mentioned Dope with Lime. This was a column that Lillian E. Smith wrote in a literary journal. What did that term mean?
So Dope with Lime was basically when Coke was a lot sweeter, you would cut the sweetness with lime. So dope was a reference for Coca-Cola.
In listening to the Dope with Lime podcast, there's a story that's true about Christmas.
Yeah, so Memory of a Large Christmas was a book she published in 1962, just recollecting growing up in a big family in Jasper, Florida, and the Christmases she had there, and then her family moving to Clayton, Georgia. One of the stories that she tells in there is about her father, who during Christmas, there was incarcerated men, black and white men, and they were working on the road in Clayton, the highway, and they were sleeping in boxcars. And he went down and talked to the guards and asked them if they could have them up to the house for Christmas. So all of the 40-something incarcerated men came to the Smith family house for Christmas and ate. And Calvin Smith, who was Lillian's dad, interacted with them, asked them who they were, learned about them. And then when they left, they were sitting there, Lillian and her family and her dad, talking. And one of the things that Lillian's dad said to her is, "We've committed sins. Hopefully you won't do this, that you will move forward." But he also said that times are going to change. Are you willing to change with them? I had a former camper from Laurel Falls Camp tell me that when she was like 6 or 7 years old, she went to the camp and she was a Callaway from West Georgia. And Lillian told her the exact same thing. She asked her, "Are you willing to change? Times are going to change. Are you willing to change with them?"
And apparently her father was sort of a progressive man himself. But here's the quote he said, "Never look down on a man. Look him in the eyes."
I love that quote because she says, "Never look down on the man. Look him in the eye. If you can't, there's something wrong with you," is the rest of that quote too. But I don't think she viewed her dad or her mom as very progressive, because one of the things she says is that, you know, they taught me about Christianity and Jesus Christ, but they didn't live that way, basically. One of the things she says about her dad is he owned mills in Florida, and he had black workers and white workers. He treated both of them negatively. He had a black church, a white church. He had a commissary store. She says one of his proudest moments was beating the devil because paying the workers to vote for prohibition. So I think that he was progressive, but I also think that she saw that there were things that Calvin and Anne, her parents, taught her that they weren't adhering to, and she was really questioning those. There's a story with this girl that she talks about that. I speculate what would have happened to Lillian's views if she lived past 1966, right? If she saw 1968 and beyond, how would her views have changed?
Let me ask you about the camps, Laurel Falls Camp for Girls in Rabun County, Georgia. Did she write at the camp? Are there any records that came from that?
Her dad started the camp in 1920. It was the first private camp in Georgia for girls. It wasn't integrated. She took it over in 1925. She came back from China. She was in China for 3 years and took it over, and she bought the camp from her parents in 28. She ran the camp till about 48. So after Strange Fruit came out in 1944. During that time, camp is a very formative moment for her. She did have Jewish campers there, which I think is very important. But around 1935 or 36, her partner, Paula Snelling, had a really bad horse accident and she almost died. Her mom's health was going down. I think another camper committed suicide. Her and Paula started a literary journal about 36. And that literary journal ran from 36 through 45. And all of those are digitized. And in that journal, they were the first journal to pay Polly Murray for one of her poems. They had a piece by W.E.B. Du Bois in it, by W.J. Cash, all of these huge luminaries. And I think that that period, she learned a lot from the people who were writing to her. The other things, too, that we found when I was digging through the camp, we actually found recordings of the camp, the campers performing plays, performing songs. There's actually records of her and Paula during their Rosenwald Fund years, and there's a recording from Talladega College in Talladega, Alabama, of songs that people were performing there when they were going around during the Rosenwald Fund travels through the South.
Well, Matthew, this has been an interesting story about a 20th century writer and her connection to a camp and to a podcast, Dope with Lime. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Matthew Touch, the director of the Lillian E. Smith Center in Clayton, Georgia, and the host of the podcast, Dope with Lime, available wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, we bring you the backstory behind another interesting name that belongs to the town, Two Egg, Florida. That's ahead on In Focus Weekend, so stay with us. From Troy Public Radio, this is In Focus Weekend, and I'm Carolyn Hutchison. If you've been listening to In Focus over the years, you might recognize the name and voice of historian Dale Cox. Dale has joined us numerous times with fascinating and often quirky stories from his hometown, Two Egg, Florida. Today, Dale is back again, this time with the history behind the name, Two Egg. Dale Cox, welcome back to Troy Public Radio by Skype. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Dale, you really have residences in two states, Alabama now and Florida. So we want to drop back because you have publicized the idea that Two Egg, Florida is a community that dates way back in our history. Can you tell us about it?
Well, yeah, Two Egg, Florida actually dates back to, I guess we could call it the antebellum time period, although it wasn't really an antebellum community. It was a very hard scrabble, dirt scratching kind of community. In the Pine Woods of Northwest Florida, it's just a few miles outside of Marianna. And if you look at a map of Florida, if you pick Tallahassee on one side and Pensacola on the other side, and you put your finger down about halfway between them, you're in Two Egg.
Well, there was a trading path that went through there, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. The old Pensacola-St. Augustine Road passed through that area, and one of its branches actually passed through Two Egg. It was a branch that crossed the natural bridge of the Chipola River. It passed directly through what would eventually become the little community of Two Egg. And I know everyone's going, you know, is he saying Two Egg? And yes, I am. It's spelled T-W-O-E-G-G. It literally is a community named Two Egg, just as if you looked in your refrigerator and you had two eggs left. It is spelled Two Egg.
Well, everyone can't wait to hear how it got that name.
Well, Two Egg was originally called Allison, and it was a little sawmill community, and I'm sure people are familiar with these little sawmill communities that existed back in the 1920s and 30s. And there was a store there. Now, it was not a company store. This was a private store. And people would go there to trade or to buy, you know, necessities that they needed for their homes. When the Great Depression hit, tough times came. Now, my dad, who grew up there, he always told me they didn't really notice the Depression coming because they were already depressed. And he said that when the Great Depression came, they ran out of hard cash quickly. So people immediately began to trade at the store. You know, they fell back on the barter system, as people are prone to do during hard times. They would take in stuff off the farm. If you had a chicken, you would take it into the store and you'd trade this chicken for what you needed from the store. This worked pretty well for a while until the Beavis brothers, who ran the store, began to slowly lose their business and sort of lose their minds in the process, because the companies that they did business with in Dothan to get the resupply they needed for their store finally had all the chickens and hams and whatever from the farms that they needed, and they finally needed hard currency for the commodities that they were selling them for the stores. I don't want to say that these guys were short-tempered, but they used to actually box each other out in front of the store as a way to draw in customers on Saturday afternoons. And so in Two Egg, or in Allison as it was known at that time, there were a lot of members of the Williams family. And the Williams family was an African-American family. They still live in Two Egg today. One of the members of the family, he had two young sons that he would send up to the store at Two Egg to trade, or his wife would, to trade for two eggs worth of sugar every day. And what she was doing was taking sugar and mixing it with cornbread. And this would kind of sweeten the cornbread, but it would also give the cornbread a boost of extra carbohydrates. It would give these kids of the family a little bit extra energy in the morning to get them out the door on their way to school or to the fields or wherever they were going for the day. So every day, these two young fellows would go in the store and trade for two eggs worth of sugar. On one particular day, they came in, and in the store, talking to one of the Beavis brothers, was a traveling salesman, and they called them drummers back in those days because they would go around drumming up business. And the two little fellows came in and they asked Mr. Beavis for 2 eggs worth of sugar. And as the story goes, Mr. Beavis just lost it. And apparently he rampaged up and down behind the counter. He said, blankety, 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 blank. All this is a blankety, blank, 2-egg town. The drummer or the traveling salesman thought it was hilarious. And they always had to have a good approach line when they, approached a home. So he began using this as his approach line as he visited homes in the area. You know, as he came up and knocked on a door, he would say, hey, did you hear what happened down in Allison this morning? And the people at the home would say, well, no, I didn't. And so he would tell them this 2-egg story. You know, the only thing faster than the internet is gossip in a small town. And so this 2-egg story began to spread like lightning. So when this particular drummer got back to Louisiana, where he was from, he packaged up what Mr. Beavis had ordered from him. And on the package, he wrote Beavis Store, Allison, Florida. And he thought about it, and he crossed out Beavis Store, and he wrote 2-egg Store, Allison, Florida, and shipped it. And it got to the post office in Greenwood, Florida, which at that time was the post office for Allison. And the postmaster at Greenwood by this time had heard this 2-egg story. And so he crossed out Allison, Florida on the package and wrote in 2-egg Florida and shipped it on to Mr. Beavis. When he saw the 2-egg store, 2-egg Florida, he lost it again and went on to another blankety, blankety, blank rampage. Word of this got back to the postmaster, who then began to cross out Allison, Florida on all of the poor man's mail. So then the state road department, today's Florida DOT, came around. The depression is on, and the WPA, or Works Progress Administration, you know, was providing money for people to go out and do different jobs. And one of the jobs they provided money for was to do a new highway map of the state of Florida. And so the individual working on the new highway map was going to different post offices and checking to make sure little communities still existed and needed to be on the map. And so he asked the postmaster about Allison. And the postmaster said, oh, no, that's not Allison anymore. That is now 2-egg. So he told him the 2-egg story. And as the story goes, in 1939, Allison disappeared from the state highway map of Florida, and 2-egg appeared. And as we all know, you know, once the transportation department decides something, it is done for good. And 2-egg is now officially part of the landscape of the state of Florida.
So, Dale, where is it?
The best way to describe it is that it's on Highway 69 between the little towns of Greenwood and Grand Ridge. Those are in Jackson County, Florida, near the town of Mariana. It's about 20 miles south of Dothan, right in that little nook of the Florida Panhandle. It touches both Alabama and Georgia, and that's where 2-egg is located.
Well, your listeners can find out all about it in your book, 2-egg Florida. And one thing I noticed, 2-egg has been on the cover of Life magazine during World War II and also featured in National Geographic. Plus, the actress Faye Dunaway is from the Bascom 2-egg area of Florida.
Yes, the farms at 2-egg. Faye Dunaway, Academy Award-winning actress, was born at that site.
Thank you so much for joining our book series here at Troy Public Radio with your classic 2-egg Florida book.
You are very welcome. I'm happy to do that.
That was historian Dale Cox, author of the book 2-egg Florida. You can find information about Dale Cox and 2-egg at YouTube and the Explore Southern History website. Thanks for joining us today as we learned the colorful backstories behind a podcast and a small Florida town. We have more interesting stories for you over the noon hour most weekdays on Troy Public Radio. You can also subscribe to our podcast and never miss a future episode of In Focus. I'm Carolyn Hutchison, thanking you for joining us and wishing you a great weekend. This is Troy Public Radio.